Welcome to Covering Recovery. This is a panel co-sponsored by IRE and the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma. I'm Bruce Shapiro. I'm executive director of the DART Center, which is a project of Columbia Journalism School, which focuses largely on covering the aftermath of violence, conflict, and tragedy, including natural disaster, human-inflicted disaster, and all sorts of other things, globally and in the U.S. I'm going to be moderating and not saying too much, but I did want to introduce this in a couple of ways. First of all, clearly the idea of covering aftermath is a doubly relevant issue here and today. It's relevant here because we're in New Orleans, which even without Hurricane Katrina is something, is a city that knows something about disaster and something about recovery. And the work of journalists here, both during and after the storm and to this day, to lay out lines of accountability and set markers for recovery in all kinds of dimensions has been an example to many of us. Obviously, we also all have in mind, though it's a human-inflicted disaster, not a natural one, the weekend's terrible events in Orlando. And in a way, these events have something in common. Large natural disasters, mass shootings, other catastrophic events attract lots and lots of press coverage when they are happening. Much less attention in the long aftermath. Now, of course, we are investigative reporters, but sometimes knowing how to make sense of the long aftermath of disaster is something that we don't have the greatest tools for. There is, after all, the human aftermath, psychological. There's the physical aftermath of rebuilding. And there is the business of aftermath, the agencies, the companies, the contractors, the financiers, the labor markets, that all in one way or another are engaged by what is not a 1 month or 1 year period of recovery from large-scale disasters, but something that goes on for a very long time. We are really lucky to have an extraordinary panel here today. We were supposed to have Erwin Redlener, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness. Happily for him, unhappily for us, his daughter gave birth to a baby this afternoon, right when he was supposed to be on a plane coming here. So I'll share some thoughts of Erwin's and frame this discussion with some thoughts connected to him, but he's not here with us. On the other hand, we do have, and I'm just going to kind of go right to left for no reason except that that's the way I'm looking right now. We do have Laura Sullivan from NPR and Justin Elliott from ProPublica, who have been working on an extraordinary collaboration for more than a year now, looking at the Red Cross, its effectiveness, questions about integrity, all sorts of things. It's not very often that I get to say, hooray, Chuck Grassley, but today, Senator Chuck Grassley, in response to the reporting by these two and their colleagues, made some quite blistering statements about the Red Cross, which are reported on NPR and I think probably on ProPublica's site today. So this is a high-impact story whose impact extends into the last few hours. That's really very nice. Congratulations. I used to cover the Senate Judiciary Committee, so when I say I haven't had many opportunities to say, hooray, Chuck Grassley, I'm kidding.
In defense of Chuck Grassley, I think he actually has a lot of good investigators on his staff.
No, he does. and in defense of Chuck Grassley on anything except Supreme Court appointments, he actually does stand very much for integrity in government and stuff like that. So over to my immediate left is Jason Berry, who's reporting from the state of Louisiana, I first knew many years ago for his pioneering work on sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. The first incisive reporting that led to the snowballing mountain of investigative journalism that, of course, today is a worldwide affair and which has been popularized in Spotlight, and more about that later. But Jason started it in a lot of ways and deserves the credit for that. But he's here today because, as a devoted journalist citizen of this state, he has been covering the aftermath of Katrina and has been on that story for 10 years now. And when we're talking about covering aftermath, that kind of trajectory is what we're looking at. And then finally, on my far left, we have Rick Young from Frontline, which also has been partnering with NPR, but on a different story, looking at the aftermath of Sandy and issues connected with that. We'll learn different things from all of them. First, I wanted to share just a few thoughts from my friend Erwin Redliner, MD, because he has been looking at disasters all over the world. I asked him to come and talk today about insufficiently covered recovery issues and sources and methods that would be useful to you guys, and also a general perspective of a doctor and public health leader who is a specialist, who spent a lot of time in this city, a lot of time in New York working on Sandy, a lot of other places. Here's what he says, and I would put this as food for thought for the broader agenda. The essence of my message is straightforward. It's this: America has been and remains disconcertingly unprepared to prevent, respond to, and recover from large-scale disasters. It's not the large emergencies or the small contained disasters that I'm worried about. It's what we call the mega disasters, catastrophic events that overwhelm local resources and require substantial and continuous external help that the nation still doesn't have down. We have, as far as recovery, we have no clue how to manage large-scale disaster recovery in ways that minimize the stress and trauma still being experienced by communities and families. Some $48 billion were appropriated for Superstorm Sandy recovery. It was initially distributed to some 18 different federal agencies, then state and local counterparts. But people are still struggling. What happened? Who's accountable? And things are getting worse. Budget cuts for preparedness and response have been on a downhill ride that has been unrelenting for the last 12 years. Now, for instance, hospital preparedness appropriations have dropped by more than 50%. Even counterterrorism support is on the chopping block. There are stories in here, guys. Even in these days of Paris, San Bernardino, and Orlando, our Congress can't get it together to do what we need to make sure America is as prepared as it should be or could be. If ever there was a greater need for high-level, intense, analytic, investigative reporting about a critical issue for a country, I don't know when that would be, when else that would be. Many of you already are engaged in helping the public and policymakers account for their actions. Lack of actions necessary to make America more resilient. You've begun to investigate the big agencies like the Red Cross. You are trying to untangle the dysfunctional morass to see where we are and why we are where we are. But there's much more to do. You are America's first and last hope. Thanks. And then Erwin sent out or prepared this very helpful tip sheet, which his colleague Sonia, can you hold up your hand, has and will hand out. And he lists, and I'm just going to throw this out here right at the beginning, a few areas that are ripe for investigation that he thinks are getting insufficient scrutiny. Funding for hospital disaster preparedness that's been cut by 50% since 2004, by public health preparedness more than 30%, and proposed 2017 budget cuts for counter-terror efforts of almost 50%. How will these funding cuts affect local preparedness? Planning for vulnerable populations in large-scale disasters, a major and dangerous omission. Are citizen preparedness programs effective? How do we measure their success? Vaccine development that is still primitive and prolonged. It's impossible to produce essential vaccines in a timely manner. Failing infrastructure and the consequence of climate change, drastically increasing disaster vulnerability. Recovery that is complex. How do we measure recovery? How to account for perception versus objective measures? How, and this is dear to my heart, how and why to find meaningful personal stories about recovery in the aftermath of a major disaster. We'll talk about these, but also many other issues with our panel today. I think because we are in New Orleans, I'm going to give kind of the honor of starting out to Jason. And also because he now has been looking at one disaster and its aftermath for a long time, and I think you have a lot to tell us. Each of the panels is going to spend 10 minutes or so, then we'll have time for conversation both on the panel and in the room. So.
Thank you, Bruce, and I know I speak for everyone in the room in saying that that was such a ray of sunshine, everything you had to say. The apocalypse is at hand. Who's going to cover it and how? I go first. I want to give you a series of snapshots about what happened here over the last 10 years. And I guess the overarching theme, and it is because we are in the state of Louisiana, is that when you follow the money, the story that is still unfolding here is how the state milked the city. The first 10 minutes, if you will, in the broad scheme of life, added up to roughly a year. The hurricane hit, the levees broke, the city flooded, everybody watched this disaster day after day, week after week. And of course, the villain was the federal government. George W. Bush flew over in an airplane, didn't go down when he should have. Comparisons with LBJ, who was on the ground during Hurricane Betsy, proliferated. So then the Bush people realized, we've got to fix this. George W. Bush came back again and again and again to this city. He really wanted to show that he had compassion, and he also wanted to show that FEMA could finally get it right. Well, we are here today with a sparkling city, even with the occasional sinkholes that beset any metropolis in these latitudes. New Orleans is probably in better shape than it has been in my lifetime, perhaps even in the entire history of the city. Yes, we still have terrible crime. Yes, we have drugs. Gentrification has set in. There are all kinds of tensions, but the city is robust. And so much of the infrastructure repair is because of FEMA and the various federal allocations that the current mayor, Mitch Landrieu, has been able to get and to use intelligently. 2 years after the hurricane, the city was still pretty much in a shambles. There were whole areas that were dark at night, off the grid. It was almost a nightmare zone. I did an interview with a guy named Ed Blakely, who for a time was Mayor Ray Nagin's expert on rebuilding. Blakely has quite a history as an urban policy maven. He once said that in the aftermath of 9/11, to watch the various agencies of New York City come together in response to that horrific terrorist assault was like watching poetry. Really interesting quote. So I did this interview with him, and I could tell that he had a lot more he wanted to say. There was a lot I wanted to know. So I invited him to dinner. He came over to my house. My wife was out of town, and he had a driver. and he made the drivers sit in the car outside of the house. And I was cooking a couple of steaks. I had a bottle of wine. I said, look, bring the guy in. He says, no, his job is to wait here. You getting a picture of Ed Blakely? So this is a man who was in supreme command of everything he believed, and he believed that everyone should believe everything he knew. So we sat down, had a cocktail, and I said, there's one thing that's really been eating at me. What should have happened in this city after the hurricane that did not? And he answered like that, and he said, the state should have fronted $500 million to the city to begin immediate rebuilding and gone to court immediately suing FEMA to get the money back. It's a pretty brilliant answer, and frankly, I think it might have worked. Instead, what we had were months turning into years in which very little money hit the ground. There was a program called Road Home, which allocated federal money to the state to give homeowners the difference between what the insurance companies would pay for their rebuilding of their houses. Remember, 80% of the city was underwater, average level 4 feet. So there were tens of thousands of homes that needed serious rebuilding. I was lucky. We had 18 inches. It was in the yard. It didn't get into the house. So at the slow pace at which all this money began to finally come down, sank the incumbent governor, Kathleen Blanco. She threw in the towel, did not run again. Blakely ran afoul of just about everybody in the state. He left. Nagin finished out his term and now has an endowed chair in a federal penitentiary. So what really happened here? It took me about 5 years to figure it out, but here's what happened. Now, I'm going to try to tell this story as briefly as I can. About 2 months after the flood, Lieutenant Colonel Russell Honoré, who was leading the federal presence here, got a group of soldiers together with volunteer nurses and doctors from Charity Hospital, a massive institution, 14 stories, built during the Depression under the muscle of Huey P. Long. This was the place of medical service for generations of poor folk, and it had been closed. Within a period of a couple of weeks, they got it open again. And he gave the keys to Governor Blanco, and she said, thank you, we have other plans. So they shuttered Charity. I'm giving this to you fast forward. The LSU system, this is the story of a hospital, and it's the story of one of the greatest boondoggles in Southern or maybe even American history. Think the Big Dig in Boston, if you will. Very briefly, what happened was the state university system realized this is our chance to get the big federal largesse so we can build the big, new, gleaming hospital in New Orleans to make our medical school a shining star. And they had a few miscalculations. First, it took about a year and a half to drive up the cost of what FEMA would put in. Under the law, if you have a facility that has been severely damaged, if you go to 51% of its value, you can take that money and use it as a down payment and build a comparable one. FEMA was going to give $35 million to repair the rest of Charity. It took about 2.5 to 3 years, but thanks to a lot of hot politicking, FEMA went up to $475 million. Bingo, down payment for the new hospital. By this time, the entire neighborhood where the hospital was to be, good old late 19th, early 20th century shotgun houses, all of them flooded, all of them getting, most of them getting road home grants, average grant, $59,000 federal dollars. They had to uproot the entire neighborhood. And by the way, all the federal money that went into restoring that neighborhood, lawsuits proliferated. So the great teaching hospital with cost overruns, I've got 3 minutes, I'm going to do it fast. The great teaching hospital soon decided that they weren't going to have an OBGYN clinic. I ran into a prominent state elected official in a bookstore, of all places, and I asked him, how much is that hospital going to cost? And he looked at me, and mind you, this is the state legislature now having to pay for the hospital after it's built. How much is it going to cost to run? And he just looked at me and said, it's going to cost forever. Well, Bobby Jindal, who was the governor over the last 8 years, he just left office, made medical reform his centerpiece of his agenda. He privatized, or began the process of privatizing, six public health hospitals that had been functioning pretty well since the Huey Long era. And at the same time, all of this money began to pour in from state coffers to prop up this new hospital. And those two financial lines collided. In other words, you can't privatize hospitals, which means you have to use state and federal grants to make the magic of the marketplace work. And at the same time, just have this sluice way of money going into this big white elephant. So we began this year with a $1.5 billion deficit. It may not seem like much if you're in Washington. Jindal inherited a $900 million surplus. So now they're battling it out in Baton Rouge, trying to raise taxes, gouge higher education, as they've been doing for years. And so that big hospital, to me, is the ultimate story of Katrina. We don't really know yet how much it's going to cost, but it's here, and it's spurred economic development in New Orleans, and the real question is, how long will the state pay for it? The question to me is, will they end up selling it?
And let me just ask you one thing before I let you go, and then we can come back to you. If you were dropped into some other city, Houston or Miami, in the wake of a big hurricane, and you had to look one place at one story, knowing what you now know, what would it be?
I would look at the state government. I would look at the governor. I would look at the people around him. I'm not talking about disaster relief, disaster management. I mean, that is a function of how well a state is organized. But I would look at the repair and how they plan to do it.
Okay, great. We'll come back to you. Rick, you're kind of at you're looking at a disaster not 10 years ago, but 3 years ago now, Superstorm Sandy. You and Frontline and NPR looked at the business of disaster, right? Talk a little bit
about...
All right. Then
very
let's, then
smooth.
Let's do it in that
very
way.
Smooth.
Fair enough. Intervention gratefully accepted.
I just take it away, guys.
I officially hand this over to Justin. Take it away.
Only because chronologically that makes sense.
That's true.
So I want to give a few sort of practical reporting tips, and this is sort of much more narrowly focused on the Red Cross, which is what I and Laura and another colleague of mine at ProPublica, Jesse Eisinger, have been covering on and off for the last 2 years now. This was a story that originally Jesse and I thought was going to be a one-off in the beginning of 2014. What happened was, and I think this story is instructive about how one can go about reporting on these things, is so Sandy was in late 2012, giant storm that hit New York and New Jersey. And so about 2 years later, a year and a half after that, we got a tip. It wasn't a particularly great or meaty tip, but it was basically from somebody associated with state government who said, you know, the American Red Cross, which is a private nonprofit, although it was chartered by the government, so it has a sort of quasi-governmental status, had raised several hundred million dollars from private donors after Sandy. And a couple years after the storm, no one in state government, or this is what the tip said, was that no one in the state government could really figure out where all that money had gone. And we knew literally nothing, less than nothing about covering disasters. We lived in New York and had experienced Sandy. But so we started looking around. We thought this was worth a week or two of reporting to just try to figure out. And so we called the Red Cross and we talked to them and we looked at their website. And if you go to their website, and this is the same, most sort of nonprofits in this space, you basically will find a page that has some glossy pictures of disaster victims and, in this case, sort of Red Cross branded trucks and this sort of thing. But in terms of actual details of what happened to, in this case, I think it was around $300 million, there's basically nothing. I think, and Laura, correct me if I'm wrong, they gave a breakdown into like four categories that was like feeding, shelter, a couple other things I can't remember. And so we asked them for more details, and we had a very sort of cordial, non-adversarial interview with an official there, and they basically just wouldn't tell us anything else. So then we did what probably anyone in the room would do, which is we went to their 990, their nonprofit, and it turns out the 990 has literally nothing about specific disaster responses. I mean, the Red Cross is like a $3 billion revenue a year organization. Their 990 just tells you nothing if you want to report on a particular disaster. So at that point, we didn't really have any answers. And so the options were either to sort of drop it, not write anything, double down and try to like find more sources, or do what we ended up deciding to do, which was to just write a story saying that we couldn't figure out where the money went. And so we wrote maybe like a 1,500-word story that just was published on ProPublica saying that the sort of post-Sandy spending was a black box. And then my first sort of practical tip for reporting on the Red Cross, and I think this would apply to a lot of other things after disaster, what we did was we just put a line at the bottom of the story saying, if you have any information about this, email my email, justin@propublica.org. And what we realized later is that one of the things that works to your advantage in covering disasters is that the universe of potential sources is very large. You have a lot of people who are affected, of course, but then you have potentially thousands of people who were responders. You have government officials. You have officials at the various nonprofits that were involved. So we ended up several weeks or a couple months later getting initially it was a Red Cross worker who leaked us some documents about internal assessments that we later published about the Red Cross response to Sandy and it's basically, to make a long story short, what a fiasco it was. And so we got these documents, which was a stroke of luck, and and at that point realized there was clearly a bigger story here. And that was when we linked up with Laura and started doubling down, and we knew that there was a bigger story, so we launched a bigger effort to find sources to flesh out what these documents were saying. But none of it ever would have happened if we hadn't made an explicit call out for tips, which is something I actually do on all of my stories now, because I think we sometimes maybe assume that potential sources will just email you, but sometimes, you know, a little nudge is helpful. Let me give one other thing. The other sort of practical tip is, and again, this is sort of specific to the Red Cross, but so because the Red Cross is a private nonprofit, even though it has a sort of quasi-governmental status because it was created by Congress in the, around the year 1900, you cannot FOIA the Red Cross. However, you can FOIA state, federal, and local agencies that interact with the Red Cross. So one of the things that we did early on and that we later recreated with other reporting was we sent in some FOIAs to various state agencies in New York and New Jersey that we thought would have had interactions with the Red Cross, asking for things like communications between those agencies and the Red Cross and materials that mentioned the Red Cross, information about the disaster response, essentially. And actually what happened from that was in the first instance, we didn't actually end up getting any particularly useful documents, but something else happened that ended up being very useful, which was I got a letter from the law firm Gibson Dunn, which is this, you know, big corporate law firm in New York. They had been hired by the Red Cross. It turns out that the New York public records law has a special exemption for trade secrets. And if you're requesting information from a government agency that relates to a third party that might include trade secrets, essentially what happens is the government agency gets your FOIA request. Then they are required to alert the third party, and the third party has the opportunity to object. So what happened was the Red Cross hired this law firm at, I believe their lawyer was actually like Mark Zuckerberg's lawyer, so it probably cost like $1,200 an hour or something, to say that the documents we were seeking contained trade secrets. So when I got this letter, I was like so confused. I mean, this sort of joke in our office was like, if the Red Cross had figured out some particularly effective way to respond to disasters, they didn't want to tell the Salvation Army or something. Like, what could? I mean, it's sort of funny, but I mean, so what we end up doing, and at that point again, we hadn't even decided to delve into this as some sort of long project. So what we did again was we just wrote about it because, you know, we weren't going to hire a lawyer and fight this or anything like that. So that story about them trying to protect these documents on the basis that they were trade secrets ended up going sort of viral. And again, we had a line about asking for tips, and that ended up yielding more information. And really what helped us report the story was that there were a lot of people inside the Red Cross, which is an organization with more than 20,000 employees, who felt that the leadership of the organization had been making bad and, in some cases, maybe unethical decisions, and were willing to talk to us. So those are two things, FOIA early and, you know, ask for tips.
Okay, so my version of that story is that, so they've been at this for a few months, and I was at NPR doing something totally different. And they called up and they said that they had gotten this document out of this. They had posted these stories, and they had gotten this document, this internal document from these top senior officials saying that the Red Cross was diverting a whole bunch of resources toward public affairs, and they were driving trucks around instead of helping people, and they were doing all this crazy stuff. And I distinctly remember, I will never forget this, because Jesse said on the phone, look, we got this document. We're just going to do a story. It's a three-day story. Do you want to, like, jump in and do the three-day story with us? And at that, I had never done a partnership before. And at that particular moment, at that particular week, I was like, yeah, actually, I don't have anything to do this week. So I was like, I'll do your three-day story. So I was like, sure. So I think that's so funny, because here we are, what, 2 years later covering the Red Cross? So what ended up happening was, so they have this amazing document, and so the reason it became like a bigger story than the 3 day story about, we were just, and I was like, great, let's do a story about this internal document. So they had already lined up an interview with the head of the public relations department at the Red Cross, and they were going to go do this interview. So now we were partners, we were officially partners, right? And so they called up the Red Cross and said, oh, and by the way, NPR is going to join us in the interview, and Laura Sullivan from NPR is going to join us in the interview. And the head of public relations from the Red Cross said, no, and we will no longer do the interview if you bring her. So then it was like, and you know, to this day, I'm still touched by this. I really am. Like, they said that night, this is the night before the interview on our three-day story, and Jesse and Justin said, well, then we can't do the interview. I mean, it was really. I'd never done a partnership before. I get, you know, you got to go all in, right? And you got to go all in like 4 minutes later, you know? So that was, so then now we've got a document, and now we have no way to vet it. Because, you know, if you have a document, you can just do like, well, this is the document and this is the response and there's your three-day story, right? But now you've got a document and you don't know, is it real? Is it true? What is it really saying? What's going on in the organization? You got to do, you got to spend all the time and investigate it. So a couple days later, I get a call from the head of public affairs at the Red Cross, Susie DeFrancis, and she says, here's the thing. We really have not enjoyed working with the reporters from ProPublica, and so if you would like to do the interview with us, you can do it, but you cannot have Jesse or Justin at the interview. And I was like, what is going on here? So at that point, I said, I cannot do that. I was like, we can't do that. I said, we can't do that. Absolutely not. And so then she said, well, then no interview for you. So that was that. And so now you've got a three-day story, but it becomes so much more complicated. And I will never understand their PR strategy to the day I die. I do not understand many things that they've done over the past 2 years, but this one especially, because they took what would have been just a pretty simple hit and turned it into 2 years of investigative stories. Because when we started digging into this document, all of a sudden we started realizing that there were some serious questions about where the money went and how they were spending the money on the ground, and it turned out not to be good. So so it went from there, but you know, and then that story led to another one, to another one, and at one point the Sandy story led to an investigation, and Justin and I went down to Haiti. We did a story in the aftermath of Haiti. We couldn't figure out where the $500 million went, and we went to try to figure out where the $500 million went. And I just, you know, I find it, to me, the idea that you know, almost 2 years ago, we were sitting around saying, where did the money for Sandy go? And then this morning, we published a story saying, we still don't know. Red Cross doesn't even know where the money went for Haiti. So where we started is kind of where we ended up, except that this morning we were able to show that a quarter of the money that they said went to Haiti went to their own internal expenses, which is significantly higher than they've said before. So,
and if I can just make one other point about two points about international disasters. So one sort of strange thing about the American Red Cross is whenever there's a big disaster that makes headlines abroad, the one that we focused on was the earthquake in Haiti in 2010, but this has been true for various large tsunamis. Politicians and other people get on TV and say, you know, sort of give to the American Red Cross. One thing we realized that, again, is not at all clear if you read their sort of press materials, is that the American Red Cross they have very few people that actually do international response. Mainly what they do, or what they're sort of supposed to do, is respond to domestic disasters. That's in their congressional charter, and then also even very small sort of like neighborhood house fire type of things. So it turns out what's happening when people give money to the American Red Cross, and we now just posted a million documents about this in Haiti, if for international disasters, is they're taking a large chunk of the money both for their sort of traditional overhead and other kinds of administrative expenses, and then mainly distributing it to other groups, other, in some cases, well-known groups like Habitat for Humanity, that sort of thing, and which are then doing the actual projects in Haiti in this case. So it's almost like how the United Way used to work, but I don't think people realize that. Two other quick points. Another thing about the Haiti story I thought was key in terms of just practical advice was after we published the Sandy story, we again thought we were done. Then we again started hearing from Red Cross employees saying you should really look at Haiti. And so we started looking at Haiti, and the key to that story ended up being just sort of showing up and going there, which is didn't take any sort of genius reportorial instinct on our parts. But when you go to a place, and I think this would apply for disasters in the United States as well, what you can do very simply is just sort of compare what's happening in specific places to what claims have been made by whatever entity it is, and I think this would go for governmental entities as well. And sort of in the most striking case in Haiti, we went to this neighborhood in Port-au-Prince called Campeche, where this sort of that the Red Cross, the reason we knew about it is because that the Red Cross had tattered it on their website as this great project, and we didn't know anyone there. We literally just showed up with our translator, within 10 minutes, we had been introduced to the sort of local community leader who was just, and his friends who were just absolutely furious with the Red Cross, had all these documents that they showed us about promises that had been made, took us around. I mean, this didn't take any kind of like great reportorial skill or anything other than just showing up. So I'd encourage you to do that. But, yeah.
But boy, was the Red Cross mad at us over that one. Oh, boy. We got into it with them over that because they were like, you had no right to go to our neighborhood. That's what they said. And while we were down there, so we're walking around, and these people are furious. I mean, they said that they had spent $24 million in Haiti, right? I mean, that is such an enormous amount of money. We're in this neighborhood, and it looks like any other neighborhood, and it doesn't. Like, it doesn't even look like they'd spent $100,000 there, let alone, like, $24 million. And the people couldn't believe, when we showed them the Red Cross's own press release, that they had spent $24 million in their neighborhood. They were astounded by this, and they were angry. And so they were expressing all of this to us. And then a few hours later, we get this email from Public Affairs in Washington that says that that we are down in the neighborhood and that we are inciting violence. And that if anything should happen to anybody in the neighborhood, if a riot should start, or if any of the Red Cross people are injured, that they will hold Justin and I personally and our news organizations responsible for anything that should happen. And we were like, we gave the people your own press release. That's what we did. We walked to the neighborhood and said, this is what the Red Cross says they're doing. Is this what's happening in your neighborhood? So, and then when we did sit down with them, that was a very tense conversation. And they said that, Susie DeFrancis said that she had never in her life seen reporters go without asking the Red Cross's permission to a neighborhood, to one of their projects, and that this was so beyond anything, that this was amateur hour, this was so beyond anything that she had ever seen before, and that we should have asked their permission, and they would have guided us through the neighborhood or whatever this thing was. And I remember saying, we were in the Red Cross building at that same time, and I just kept saying, but it's not your neighborhood, you know. It's a neighborhood in Haiti. And she was like, this is the way it's done. These are what I've been in this business for 20 years. I've never seen a reporter act like this, like blah, blah, blah. I was like, if I was coming here to the Red Cross building, I would not walk in the door and say, I'm just going to wander around your building. Yes, I would ask you, obviously, for permission to enter your building. And she was like, thank you. That is exactly what I'm saying. And I was like, the neighborhood in Haiti is not a Red Cross building. And to this day, we're still at odds over this issue.
Well, and we'll come back, but I need to move things along here. I mean, what you're describing is really, and I think everyone's repertorial blood starts to pump at this, because what you're really describing is an agency acting kind of like an authoritarian state. Rather than the kind of warm and fuzzy feeling that the words Red Cross typically evokes.
Susie used to be a flack for the George Bush administration.
This is a nonpartisan profession here.
This resume information.
Yeah. Rick, when you guys worked on this and you're looking at Sandy, one of the things you ended up focusing on in your piece was insurance companies, what they did. Talk a little bit about the sort of the decision making process and how you came to focus that. And
yeah, so my introduction to reporting on disaster actually was the very first people that I talked to, which I think is actually kind of unusual, were Laura and Justin. And I think that actually says something about where we are at this point in time. There's such a interest and all the buzz about collaboration and multi-platform reporting. And the interest at Frontline, to be honest, was let's do some work with NPR. And also ProPublica, we've worked with a lot, but we should be doing some more collaborative work, and so let's see what NPR is up to. And so I went over, and they had obviously done a lot of reporting about the Red Cross. I sat down to try and learn a little bit more about what I'd listened to their stories, but hear a little bit more about where they were going with their reporting. And we talked for a little while, and we continued to talk a little bit more about going beyond just the Red Cross and what was going on with disaster recovery, long-term recovery in general. Where was all the money going from both federal government and from state government as well? And Frontline was interested in a bit of a wider lens, in part because they covered the territory pretty well, and so what was their real value in going back over that? And you know, actually one of the first people that I talked to was Erwin Redlener, and I got that lecture, and he sold me. Actually, I think he's on point. You know, this is an area that clearly, I mean, I don't think anybody or very few people would dispute that it's a problem that's not going to keep coming back and keep coming back more frequently and more intensely. And as I looked at it as well, at least from a broadcast standpoint, sort of a big takeout, nobody had really taken a look at the system writ large in terms of where all the money was going, how well were people doing years after a major disaster had hit. And the other piece of that was the fact that we were now approaching three years out on Sandy. And I think that was an important point for us, because 3 years seemed like a ripe time, that enough had happened. You had some lawsuits that had taken place. You had some reporting about insurance settlements that were actually much lower than people thought they should be, and even some reporting about fraud, possible fraud, in some of the work that the engineering firms were doing for the insurance companies. So we had a period of time where there was a track record to look at, and also we knew that from a filmic standpoint, we knew that we could go out and watch what was happening on the ground, and that was pretty important, because a lot of times when you're doing these investigative films, you're going back and trying to, in essence, recreate something that's happened, which is very hard filmically. But if you could get on the ground and actually see it play out, that offered all kinds of opportunities that we took advantage of, putting Laura out into the field. Laura became the correspondent, by the way, in the piece that ran, I should have said, Business of Disaster, that ran a couple weeks ago. That
you
gave
can
us
see it online.
Yeah, you can, indeed. So the ripeness of the story was important to us. I don't know that, you know, in terms of sort of the process of reporting, I think it was pretty similar to a lot of different stories. You immediately go out and look for ambassadors on the ground to introduce you to victims. I think in that case, long-term recovery groups, if you don't know them, you should get in touch, you know, should learn about them. They get set up in communities, and they're a great source for contacts and information. They know the people. They're working with the people trying to help them. Then you also find your rabbis, the folks that have the 30,000-foot view. Erwin was one of them, for example. But we also found some veterans of disaster management, people that had worked in FEMA for years and could talk to us about that and the problems. Ultimately, it was about money, chasing money, trying to figure out where, you know, if the homeowners weren't getting the money, if they weren't getting paid from insurance companies, where was that money going? And what we found was that in this case, nobody, even FEMA, didn't know the answer. And we got a lot of data to show. Laura, help me out on this for the details. The profits, we got information from FEMA and also from insurance company.
So we ended up looking at, the question was, well, if how much is FEMA paying the insurance companies, and then how much of that money's profit? So it seemed like a really not too complex question, because FEMA gives them a certain amount of money, and then at the same time they have to report to a national regulatory agency what their actual expenses are. So it just seems like you would subtract one number from the other and be like, wow, that's a lot of profit. So it turned out to be exactly that. I mean, it turned out to be hundreds of millions of dollars of profit. And so while the homeowners were getting screwed every year after Sandy, in the wake of Sandy, the private insurance companies walked away with $400 million in profit because FEMA pays them for the work. So it's kind of different than regular
but
insurance.
But the key here was getting the data that even FEMA hadn't been looking at. And that was the most surprising thing, was that the government agency responsible here had no idea. And we walked in and we actually had done the calculations on all of that. I want to leave time here. I just want to put a plug. The other thing that we're doing is actually a VR
project that will air in a few days, maybe. Should go up pretty soon on Facebook, and that's a whole nother. We could talk at length about that, but it's a whole nother medium, obviously, and quite the it thing at this point. So,
folks who have questions should line up at the mic, and this is a rich conversation. Let me throw out a question to start for any or all of you. You know, very important insights here about finding the right rabbis, the right experts, about noting the points of resistance and taking advantage of divisions within agencies and all that sort of thing. But what about narrative? One of the problems, one of the challenges of investigative reporting on disasters is that so much is technical. The technicalities of recovery, the technicalities of money, the technicalities of science. How did any of you kind of think about storytelling in a way that would be compelling here?
Well, I think the challenge we actually one of the challenges of, there the, one device that's very useful is a correspondent, because in this case we literally put Laura on the road, and I have to say one of the advantages, I've worked with a lot of different correspondents, but one advantage was Laura was all in when she joined in on the project, that she was reporting 100% on this as well, which is important in these partnerships. It helps, obviously, that you get along. And for the most part, she was okay. but no, that if you're reporting together all the time, then you're also you're communicating, but you're also following the same leads. And as far as narrative, so we have a protagonist, which helps a lot. One of the challenges we faced was actually we had two separate stories because we were looking at two systems, the National Flood Insurance Program and state programs as well. And we had to thread those together. And the way that we did that then was actually to have Laura sort of chase down the money as it flowed through these systems.
Right.
Jason, you're telling a 10-year story.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
I have a very easy answer. I would suggest that every one of you go to the website of the film Big Charity and order it. It's a great investigative film made by a young Tulane graduate, Alex Glustrom, who spent 3 or 4 years. First big project, he managed to get a lot of people on the inside of the LSU system and of the state government. And he brings it right up to the point of what Jindal did and those machinations, but it's a terrific window into the story that I recounted. To answer your question specifically, though, you know, my concern, and I visited this several times in different pieces, but the longest one I did was in the Daily Beast, whenever the 10th anniversary of Katrina was, I guess. And there's a guy named Brad Ott, who is a sociologist who has spent years researching this stuff. He's a walking encyclopedia of it. And I wouldn't exactly call him a whistleblower because he doesn't work for the government, but he knows the story or main parts of it inside out. So I relied on him a lot.
Quickly, I just want to say that these stories, I mean, you're up against two problems. One is sympathy fatigue. I mean, the level of disasters that we're dealing with and that we're covering are so bad at this point. I mean, from Sandy Hook to Orlando to, I mean, what's a, you know, 100,000 people lose their homes. At this point, it's like, so what? You know, how do you get past this idea that we should even care about this stuff anymore? And how do you get people to listen to another story of horrible stuff happening in the world? And I think that the only way that you can do that is when you don't hang the story on the sad anecdote and you don't say, like, this is going to be a horrible story about this horrible thing happening. You have to drive it forward by placing... I say that these stories have two questions that have to be answered. Why is this happening and who is responsible? If you answer those two questions, you have an investigative story. Otherwise, you just have a sad story. Otherwise, you just have, like, more tragedy befalling Americans or wherever, Haitians, wherever you are. But if you ask, why is this happening? What is going on in the world that is making this happen? And then you say, who is responsible? What system? What policy? what dynamic is in place in this world that is making this happen. Then you drive your narrative forward home to a point and to a reason, and by the time you get to the end, it's almost cathartic for the people who are listening or watching or reading it. And that's when these stories rise from the level of something that's just sort of tragic and awful to, oh my God, that was amazing. And that's how you can do it.
So focused questions, focused answers, because we have not all that much time, and I want to give people a chance. Go.
My name is Matt Grant. I'm a reporter with the NBC affiliate in Orlando, and obviously this has been a really tough week for me and my colleagues. It's also uncharted territory for us. I'm just curious if you guys have any ideas for when we go back home, story ideas, questions we should be asking, things we could request, or just general advice. I'd appreciate it.
Can I just a quick thing on this from a Dart Center standpoint? First, they're actually on www.dartcenter.org. There are a fair number of resources and tip sheets on covering the aftermath of mass shootings in particular. And really understand that for your community, the story is just beginning, that there's the moment when most of the cameras go away. There may have been trust that you've spent years building up that may get damaged by the number of national and international media, but you have an opportunity to kind of rebuild and know that the story is just beginning. There are clinicians, there are researchers who will be dealing with trauma, there's lots of stuff, but Dart Center website for sure.
I mean, I think you guys are... I can't even imagine. I mean, we've all been through sort of horrible stories that we've had to cover in our careers, but this one has to be one of the absolute worst. And my heart goes out to you guys. I hate to sit here and say that. I'm glad I don't have to, you know, because it's so awful. That being said, I think you guys are still in the fire putting out time right now. I mean, you're literally, it's still breaking news, and it's going to be that way for a while. But 6 months from now, you'll probably start breaking off and doing some of the bigger sort of stories that you can't see at the time. I mean, we all look at Newtown differently now than we did when it was just all breaking in front of us. And so now we can kind of look back, and now the stories are, you know, the lawsuits and the guns and this and that and mental health and all these sort of other angles that can come out of it. And I think that this one will probably be rich for that too, because there are so many different layers to both the, you know, to the killer and to the victims. I don't know. I just want to say that your guys' coverage has been amazing, and you make us all look good, and you make us proud.
Yeah, and I would also just say two other things. First of all, Laura's point is crucial. You're now in the act one, and it's going to go on for a little while, and you'll know when you're into the act two. In this point, the other thing is really take care of yourselves. This is a marathon that you're now in, and you don't want to get to the point where you're really completely burned out. So that's something else to think about. Find ways as a newsroom and as a community of local journalists to take care of yourselves in this.
Thank you so much.
My name is Michael Williams, and I'm a student reporter for Knight News out of the University of Central Florida, which is in Orlando. Anytime a tragedy like this happens, it always seems like there's a cycle, and it always seems pretty predictable. Media coverage is intense at first, donations pour in, everybody's paying attention. However, anytime a media outlet tries to initiate a conversation about what caused this tragedy, the public immediately jumps in saying that we shouldn't politicize it when the bodies aren't even cold. Then eventually the cameras go away, so does the attention, and the public, I don't want to say they stop caring, but they stop paying attention until the next tragedy happens and the cycle continues. So my question is, when is the right time to start a conversation, whether it be about mental health, whether it be about guns, whether it be about Islam, and how do we get the public to continue to take a more proactive approach to it?
Um, I'm thinking about the cycle that you laid out. I don't know. I think we point fingers pretty quickly in our country. I think that that pretty much comes up on day two. So I don't know. I sort of feel like we go quickly for the jugular in the beginning. I guess the question is, when is the best time to cycle back? I didn't even know that people were still suffering from Sandy before we started this frontline story. I had no idea. I thought everybody was recovered. I thought New York was fine. I hadn't heard about it in years. I figured everybody was doing just fine. I had no idea. We went into people's homes, and they were still wrecked 3 years later from the storm. I was like, are you kidding me? Why doesn't anybody know this? I didn't know this, and I'm like, you know, three
Same
or four
thing
hours
happened
away.
Here.
You know?
I actually do have a thought about that, which is, I mean, I think that the Orlando story, I mean, it is, or at least one of its layers, is fundamentally political. I mean, if you, just a month ago, I was reading a story about 9/11, and there's revelations still coming out about, you know, these still classified pages about Saudi involvement. It doesn't seem like, you know, Orlando is the same type of terrorism where there's an actual network, but obviously we've already seen stories about sort of tips that were sent to police or the FBI, and so this is a political story, and I don't think there's any reason to sort of shy away from that.
I think there's a period when people are in shock and they focus on the sensational, including sensational arguments, and then there's a period later on when people are able to hear the voices of experts, are able to consider investigations, are able to lay out lines of accountability a little differently. I have a proposal, since we have little time, but I want all of you to get your questions in. If you could each just ask all of your questions, and then the panel will sort of grab at whatever we can and want in that, and we'll close out from there, okay?
Sure. Mine's pretty specific. I'm Ryan Kailath. I'm a local reporter here at the local NPR station. my question is about the Sandy story, so for whoever wants to answer it, maybe it's Laura. I know you were trying to prove what profits FEMA, or the insurance companies took. And I think you guys guessed from your math that it was about 30%, and the insurance companies came back and said, no, it was 10 to 15, we promise.
I totally heard the story.
I did.
So
I did. Well, it just aired, so I'm on top of my game.
That was impressive.
Yes.
Get to the question part.
So you said 30%. They said, no, trust us, 10 to 15, but they didn't show you the data. So you guys made a strong case that, here, look at the numbers, it's 30%. But you couldn't, you know, quite prove it, hard prove it. But I imagine you really wanted to.
Yeah.
At what point in your reporting do you just decide to call it and say, all right, we're not going to get the smoking gun?
When the lawyers let you.
Hold it. At what point?
That was the whole question.
At what point do you say basta, right? Okay. Yep. Okay.
Okay. Hi, I'm Ashley Sibman. I work for NBC's Consumer Investigative Center in Dallas. But in grad school, I worked on a project about a dam above Dallas that was just recently published, and basically worked with the Army Corps of Engineers, and it's like the ninth most dangerous dam in the country. How do you balance... We left a lot out of that report about what could happen if it fails. So how do you balance being alarmist and also trying to prepare the public?
And in a way, that's somewhat connected to the other question. Yeah.
Hi, Jessica Ansaris. I'm with the Carlsbad Current Argus. We are a small staff, but our region of the state hosts one of the nation's nuclear repository sites. So in 2014, there was a nuclear radiological release. It's a scale is a small incident, but here we are 2 years later, still covering the recovery. So I have a two-part question. The first is, any advice, tips, tricks to keep what is basically a technical story still fresh and meaningful? And second is access, because we're not dealing with public entities, we're dealing with the Department of Energy. So it's very tough. They don't believe that. We have reporters willing to go into a site that's radioactive. So sometimes it's tough to get them to cooperate.
Okay, so we've got...
Just one thing, because I want to say this before we go. If you want our tip sheet on the Red Cross, including sample FOIA requests, go to the URL on the screen and put your email in. Just wanted to get that out there.
And we can also move that over into the resource library priority.
Okay, so this is what I want to say about the 15 versus 30. So, like, These stories are tricky because why is it investigative versus just a he said, she said, right? Like what takes it from, if we had just done a story that said these documents show the insurance company takes 30%, but the insurance company says they only take 15%. It's like there's this and then there's this. And then it's like, okay, Laura Sullivan, NPR News. That's a 4-minute story on All Things Considered, right? Even Stephen, like that's all there is. But what I believe and what I fundamentally believe makes these investigative stories is that you take their response and they say it's 15%, and then you say, but that's not really true because of this. And then you take that back to them because behind the scenes while all this is playing out, you're going back and back and back over email. I mean, you're doing these lengthy email chains over and over and over again, but now you say this. Well, what about this? Well, now you say this. Until you have run that down to the very bottom, and there is nothing that they are going to say after the story airs that you have not already heard. They know what you're reporting. They have had a chance to beat you back for 2 months now on this very fact. You have run down everything they have to say. I believe that it is not, like, our job is to present the other side and to allow them to say what it is they want to say, and they can say whatever they believe is their side. But we do not have a responsibility to allow somebody to lie on our air unchallenged. And when you challenge the lie repeatedly, you drive the story forward until there is no other conclusion that what the other side is saying, what the other documents are saying, whatever else is being presented, is in fact the truth.
And I just add, which is absolutely an imperative for getting the story on the air. If you're going to get it past the editorial process and particularly past the lawyers that look very, very closely, one of the things I'll just very quickly say that we have to think about in these partnerships is that it's great to have more reporting power, but that brings more editorial attention and more legal attention. And it's actually a situation where, you know, you end up with the safest common denominator out there because everybody needs to be comfortable, has to be a consensus with what you're saying. And we went through a lot of with a lot of people involved in all of this reporting. But what Laura was pointing out in terms of that exchange, which I really encourage people to have, put your material out there. Give it to them because there's also I think there is a tendency to say, oh well, hold on to that information because you don't want them to know, and then you'll spring it on them, right? But actually, the process of just saying, hey, we've done this work, we believe in this, this is what we've got, you know, give it your best shot, and it goes back and forth. All that paper, internal paperwork, is what actually gives you the ability to go to air and get past the lawyers.
I want to go to the last question about access, because I think that's central for local and regional reporters on disaster stories and agencies that often are very close, not as close as a nuclear agency maybe, but you know, the Red Cross, you know, mom and pop, the Red Cross, no, it's a pretty closed agency. And this circles us back to the beginning of the conversation, which is remember that you don't have access only through officials of those agencies. You have access through experts in disaster preparedness or in the specific science and engineering retirees from those agencies, and that all agencies have divisions within them. And when reporters like these are pushing their documents in the face of PR folks, they're also reflecting divisions that already exist within the agencies. And so when you think about access, think about expanding your spectrum, to think about various kinds of expertise, university-based experts, retired experts, consultants who may have a perspective and often may have access through their own networks to the data that, or the ideas that you're trying to get.
Justin is one of the best I've seen at getting multiple people to give him stuff, talk to him, like more people. At one point, I remember saying to Justin, "Justin, we cannot handle any more like Red Cross sources because we cannot vet all these people."
Yeah, one thing about that, which will be on the tip sheet that you should sign up for, is that again, there's a lot of these agencies, both governmental and non-governmental, are very, very large, which is to our advantage. And LinkedIn is your friend. LinkedIn is such a powerful database with very high quality information. People put their information on there to get jobs, so it's usually very accurate. you know, if you there's a link, special LinkedIn for journalists that gives you ability to search in a more powerful way, including by past job, which really is just truly invaluable. I don't think there's anything that can replace it.
All right. Now, clearly we are having a conversation that could just be beginning. So it is just beginning, but it will continue, and to circle back to Jason's work in particular, by celebrating New Orleans this evening with the second line and the reception. And we will all talk further then, okay? Well, thank you all. Guys. Great.